Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is the British politician Tim Farron. Tim was the leader of the Liberal Democrats from July 2015 to 2017. He's been the Member of Parliament for Westmorland and Lonsdale since 2005, and he's here to talk to us today about liberalism, its origins and development, its core values, and how it might relate to the Middle Way.
Hello, Tim. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, can we begin by you telling us a little bit about your background? What drew you into politics and why it was that you gravitated towards the Lib Dems?
So I think most people in politics when they're asked these sort of questions tend to be very, very careful and think of their reasons for getting involved in politics and in their particular party in some very neat way that sort of expresses their virtue. I'm honest with you, I'm somebody who was brought up in a relatively kind of poor background in Preston. Mum and dad were split up, but I saw obviously a lot of both of them. My mum was she referred to herself as the nouveau poor, as opposed to the nouveau riche. In other words, middle class values and no cash.
Yeah.
Read The Guardian and couldn't afford it. In fact, I remember the day we actually had to cancel the subscription because she couldn't afford it anymore. And so my grandfather was definitely a Telegraph reader, would pretend to buy The Guardian and just accidentally leave it at our house. So, and my dad, who is still with us, my mum sadly isn't, I'm trying not to be in any way condescending here. He's an absolutely lovely guy, but he did not have my mother's pretensions. He is fairly traditional, Lancashire guy born in the late 1940s. Traditional values, but having said that, he was whilst having a proper job, he was a DJ for 13, 14 years in a nightclub just outside Preston. And so I had fairly youthful values. They were 20 and 21 when I was born. And so music was hugely significant, and it still is. I'm an absolute pop music anorak. I was in a terrible band. It's a great thing to do with your mates. Some people become mates with people they form a band with. I formed a band with people who were my mates, and when we stopped being in a band, we're still mates, and we're 47 and we're still mates, and that's brilliant. So we were terrible. We were once written off as a fourth rate New Order, which I was quite proud of, really. But it gives you a sense. So I was brought up Terrace House, main road between Preston and Leyland. Behind us were the gasworks, although behind us was also a farm where I did my first ever paid work, lifting hay bales and it was an interesting kind of mixture. Comprehensive school, certainly at one stage, I think it's changed now, but one stage there were more kids from our year went to prison than went to university, and that certainly was the case. I think there's a few people have gone and done degrees in their mature years since to change the balance. But so it just gives you a little bit of picture. I was interested in politics from an early age. I remember the 79 election because I missed school because they closed the school for it was a polling station. I didn't have strong opinions about any of the characters. Margaret Thatcher was interesting. It was a woman being Prime Minister. James Callaghan I felt sorry for, although I remember him saying after he'd lost the election he'd have more time to see his grandchildren. I thought, well, that sounds nice. David Steele was impressive to me because he looked like the outsider and he looked like a scrapper. And if anybody's jib I liked the cut of, it was his, but it wasn't to the exclusion of everybody else. 83 election, I remember as a 13-year-old. I remember feeling all sorts of mixed views about everybody again. I thought Steele was the person who shone as being the most interesting of the four candidates for Prime Minister, because you had Roy Jenkins as the SDP leader then to compare with Michael Foot and Margaret Thatcher. I joined the Liberals in 86. A range of things had happened in that period, that time. I saw quite a lot of housing need around me, and I happened... Anybody who's ever heard me speak will be bored silly hearing me this, but I did watch Cathy Come Home when I was 14. It did make me cry, and I wanted to do something about it. Ken Loach would have had me join the Socialist Workers Party, no doubt, but I share his compassion for those in need. I don't share his dogmatic approach as to how you solve those problems. The evidence is that he actually made them worse if you do those things in the long run. So I joined Shelter, first of all.
Okay.
Went down and bought a postal order for £1.50. Joined Greenpeace a few months later. Saw Live Aid when my dad was playing cricket one Saturday afternoon, that July day. I was bored of watching my dad's team, you know, whether they're doing badly or well, I can't remember, but I went in and watched the big screen and saw Live Aid. And of course we were subjected then not to the kind of nice, neat, sanitised, saccharine little stuff from Blue Peter Appeals, but to real full-on, very political little mini-documentaries of what the famine in Eritrea meant, and actually whose fault it was, that this was not just an unfortunate accident. This was a result of faulty politics.
Yeah.
And these sort of things sort of built themselves up. I did economics O-level. I didn't have a hatred of Mrs. Thatcher or anything like that at that point. I remember thinking, a penny dropped with me, that she was actually using high unemployment as a means to undermine the trade union movement and to keep inflation down. I saw half my mates with that. I mean, my parents were out of work from time to time, actually, my mum especially. Half my mates' parents were out of work almost all the time, their parents were. And I was devastated by this, and I was appalled and outraged by it. Got to sixth form, and I joined the Liberals, because I'm a Liberal.
Okay, well, let's dive in then. So what are the origins of Liberalism? How did it come about?
We can put people into brackets too easily.
Sure,
one of the
yes.
great things about liberalism is that it is rational, it's reasonable, it's inclusive, and it's not overly dogmatic. It's one of the things that I'm attracted to it for. So where does it come? I mean, I guess any thought process that says that forms of government that are dictatorial, unjust, arbitrary, which denies the rights and freedoms and the well-being of, you know, the common person.
Yeah.
That's where liberalism kind of comes from. And, you know, we discussed before we started recording my limited knowledge of the classical world, but I absolutely loved reading Robert Harris's Cicero trilogy over the summer. That fighting, admittedly within a very limited franchise
yeah.
of men of a certain standing in Roman society, but nevertheless a form of democracy and a belief in liberty, which can be hard fought for against people who will say they've got grand patriotic ambitions, but actually it's about taking power to themselves. So it is the ultimate power to the people, and that means making sure you prevent power being swallowed up by too few people, but also that you end up sucking away power from people by surrendering your reason to a dogma.
Yeah, that for me, that ties in with arguably one of the heroes of early liberalism, John Stuart Mill, and his argument that it enables autonomous judgment and therefore greater objectivity.
Yeah, I mean, I think John Stuart Mill was incredibly important to the development of the liberal movement in the 19th century. Essentially, you could say he kick-started the Liberal Party as it kind of came out of the sort of Whig movement
yeah.
and a small L liberal movement. And what John Stuart Mill understood, and a lot of other classical writers perhaps hadn't, is that it's about people's actual experience of liberty. If liberty is just something which is esoteric and that is somehow aesthetically pleasing, then that's no use to me or anybody else. If you are incredibly poor, you have not got the ability to access the freedoms that you technically have.
Yeah.
In reality, you don't have that. And so I would say John Stuart Mill is the father of social liberalism.
Yeah.
The idea that liberalism has to mean something for it to mean something.
Yeah.
If you are not free to actually practice the liberties that you have in theory, then you're not free at all.
So when you say social liberalism, is that in many ways how you see modern liberalism?
Yeah, I mean, the word social liberalism today, we talk about people being socially liberal or socially conservative. We talk about, you know, the extent to which we as a society promote, you know, permissive values and all that kind of thing. And that's not what I mean particularly by social liberalism. It certainly isn't what we've traditionally up until recently meant by social liberalism. It can, of course, mean that, can include that. But social liberalism is a belief in a form of government that is interventionist when it needs to be in order to promote liberty. and to protect people's liberty. And that means that, you know, taxing people, having public services, and having a welfare state, for example, is that they are key elements of liberalism. If you believe that liberalism is about freedom for everybody and not just for some, I think the danger, we might get onto this, but the danger of some concepts or of liberalism, I would say perversions of liberalism, is that we believe that somehow the natural order of humanity will lead to, you know, perfect and good outcomes, and they don't. All the evidence is that we, if you leave, for example, the free market to its own devices completely, to laissez-faire, what you get is not the, you know, invisible hand in the marketplace, much as I like Adam Smith and respect him and admire him. What you get is an invisible force, more like gravity. Those that have got plenty get loads more, and you get a broken market. So I think John Stuart Mill was key to moving away from this rather purist version of liberalism, which I think was not liberalism at all, and which sadly other people have gone back to.
Well, that's interesting. So I suppose the view perhaps still held by some people now is that we're based on self-interest, that we are basically homo economicus, but your position seems to be we're as much homo empathicus as we're homo economicus.
Yes, I mean, I think that we, I mean, of course, the one flaw in my argument is if I believe that human beings are flawed to the extent that if we have, you know, a laissez-faire economy, things go badly for the many, and indeed the few end up being inefficient. That therefore, you know, what's the referee that I'm arguing for? It's a human one, and they'll be flawed too. I think it's about self-awareness. Liberalism is about self-awareness. We need to remember all the time that we're flawed, not just in our abilities, but actually in our moral judgments. And so liberalism is a self-correcting, self-deprecating philosophy. I can't remember who it was who said it, that, and he said it in a, you know, a dismissive way, but there's a truth in it. The definition of a liberal is one who is too reasonable to take their own side in an argument.
That's fantastic.
which may describe why liberals don't win all the elections that they might. But it does mean liberalism is almost by definition the best philosophy, because it's the only one that is in any way intrinsically self-critical.
That's very, very interesting. I suppose also I'm thinking about how liberalism is perceived around the world. Like, for example, in the States, a liberal is often seen as a sort of soft socialist, arguably. But how are liberals perceived here in Europe? Well, are they perceived different on the continent than they are in the UK?
Well, it's funny, I think American liberalism and British liberalism have often had quite more in common than in many other places, because US liberals, which has generally been seen as the left wing of the Democratic Party, which is probably about the centre of the Liberal Democrats. A guy who wrote a really interesting book called Republicrat, interestingly enough, who went to work for, I think he worked for David Laws, who was, you know, by his own definition, a centre-right Liberal Democrat and, you know, latterly a minister in the UK. This guy himself counted himself as a centre-right Liberal Democrat. And interestingly enough, he was also an evangelical Christian, went to the States and was gobsmacked that he was seen as a Marxist, having been a centre-right Liberal Democrat in the UK, and also to be a Christian and to be left of centre in a US context was seen utterly, utterly bizarre, which I find fascinating and troubling personally as a Christian myself. But I also think that what has happened in the US and the UK is almost the absence of a Labour Party in the States and the presence of a Labour Party in the UK has led, for different reasons, liberals in the two countries to be really rather similar, to be people who believe in individual liberty, but also believe individual liberty is meaningless without state intervention, frankly. So actually European liberalism has often been a more classical centre-right variety, although in the Netherlands in particular, sort of D66, and in some other parts of European Union, you've seen liberal parties grow to be more like the Liberal Democrats. And actually, one of the blessings of the European Union, in particular the European Parliament, is that the Alliance of Liberal Democrats for Europe, ALDE, the Liberal Democrats party across Europe. It's sort of homogenised liberalism in our kind of area more than others. We've just seen the Free Democrats returned in Germany, which is great news. But they are, you know, they're free marketeers, but they're also good liberals. And so there is a bit of a broad church. And you've got this bizarre situation that there are two parties in the Netherlands that are in the Liberal Party in Europe. VVD, which is centre-right, that, you know, Ken Clark could happily belong to.
Yeah.
And then D66, which the majority of Liberal Democrats would probably belong to, although some would join VVD. And the fact that, I don't know where we got with coalition there yet, but in the last government, the centre-right Liberals were in government and the centre-left Liberals were the main opposition. What a wonderful situation.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. You touched on a few minutes ago about the church and state. To what degree do you think liberalism has played a part in them living side by side?
Well, interesting enough, I mean, if you could think of one trigger for the Liberal Party's success in the latter part of the 19th century, it was religious liberty. And around here, one of the underpinning strengths, I guess, of liberalism in this part of the world, in Westmorland, in Cumbria as a whole, particularly in Westmorland, is support for the current Liberal Party from people of a non-conformist, low church, Methodist, Quakerish background. And that actually does stretch back to, you know, for a variety of, there's shared values, but there's also, going back to the 19th century, the fact that the Church of England controlled everything. I mean, people couldn't go to university, they couldn't get top jobs, they couldn't get married in the place they wanted to. You were severely restricted, you know, in many ways like non-Muslims are in many Islamic states today are, just in, you know, in Victorian Britain, if you weren't Anglican. And in many ways, you stuck out more of a sore thumb, if you were one of those Christians who wasn't an Anglican, and in particular a non-conformist. I mean, arguably it was the Liberals who, under Lloyd George, made sure that the Church of Wales was disestablished, but the Church of England remains in place. And I still think, as both a Liberal and a Christian, an established church is wrong, because you can't go legislating to make people Christians who are not Christians. No. That's not how it works. Yeah. And there's also something, you know, illiberal about saying this is the state religion. And if you go back through history, it generally ends badly, whatever the religion. You know, my view is it'll be better. It will liberate the Church of England to be what it should be, rather than be part of the furniture of the state, if and when we disestablish it. And I would rather Church of England disestablished itself from a position of strength than got itself disestablished from a position of weakness at some point in the future.
I definitely agree with that, yeah. My impression, Tim, is that the Lib Dems tend to primarily use language of freedom and care and sort of emphasise the value of balance between them. It'd be interesting what your thoughts on that. But I suppose another impression that, for me, that liberalism generates, that sometimes it can gravitate towards conventional moderation. It can be seen as wishy-washy. In what ways might conventionally moderate positions perhaps be inadequate or even dogmatic at times?
Yes, I think that the word moderate is one of those phrases that apparently voters don't in any way identify with. Common sense is, if I remember it being used by William Hague when he made a rather failed attempt to revitalise the Tory party after Blair had won. William Hague is one of those people, I think, you know, who was, I should take a leaf out of his book. He's done very well since he stopped being leader. but I think possibly because he was true to himself. Afterwards, and he felt a bit contrived when he was being leader. But this common sense appropriation of that phrase, which Farage and others have used as well, has sort of sullied that word to mean anything but. It's the thing that the bloke down the pub says, the thing that Al Murray says when he's being ironic, and that, you know, millions of other people use when they're not being ironic, but, you know, they don't realise that they should be. But what is common sense? And it is to make the best judgment on the basis of available evidence. Yeah. And available evidence is that whatever your heart tells you about the state of, you know, the country at the moment, it is unwise to spend ludicrous amounts of money on revenue spending that, you know, if you have any sense, will within a decade lead to colossal austerity. So Corbyn's heart might be in the right place, but his head definitely isn't. And if your head knows it's wrong, then your heart should follow, frankly. And on the other side, I mean, that you would pursue a dogma of taking Britain out of the European Union in the most extreme version possible, by which is the Tories' current plan, because you're terrified of the electorate, or more likely because you're terrified of two or three newspaper owners and a few dozen MPs in your own party. I mean, that's the most unpatriotic thing imaginable and the most dogmatic thing. And if you look at what's best for your country, what do you want your grandchildren to experience in the next sort of 20 years' time or something? And when you answer that question, you know it's not to do what this government's doing now. And I don't consider, you know, the current Conservative government to be full of, and the most part, you know, swivel-eyed dogmatic loons. I consider them to be full of people who are prisoners of circumstance. Well, go and make your own luck rather than putting up with somebody else's. And so that's not moderation. That's about being radical, radically doing the right thing, and taking, and sometimes you go down in flames by doing radically the right thing. I nearly did here, and you know, I'm grateful that I didn't, but if I had gone down in flames, I would have been proud to do so. You know, what's the point in doing the wrong thing and winning?
Spot on then, Tim. But, well, maybe you could give me a practical example of liberal common sense. For example, when you have different objects of care, such as caring for people and caring for the environment, one of the basic needs of a population is obviously adequate housing. This is something you talked about earlier. Such housing may require the use of greenfield sites, with the subsequent depletion of wildlife, added risk of flooding, which we know we're very familiar with in this area, reduction of forest cover, etc. So what do we do in a situation like that?
Well, not point the finger at each other too much. Because I mean, so you talked about forest cover and flooding, all the rest of it. It's an interesting place to start. I'll blame George Monbiot for the next floods. And I'll blame him, not because he's wrong, but because the way he goes about it is so wrong that he makes it almost impossible that we'll ever achieve the things he wants. And so, for the uninitiated, George Monbiot has a habit of effectively saying that all modern forms of farming in the United Kingdom, and indeed traditional ones as well, cause flooding. It's all the farmers' fault. It's all the fault of people who support the farmers, and so on. First of all, he's wrong in so many ways, and even when he's right, he's wrong in the way he goes about it, because if you're dogmatic and shouty at people, you're never going to get them to change their behaviour. Yeah, so the reality is, yes, so the use of woodland in farming would potentially, in the right way, help to retain water in the upland, and potentially could help prevent flooding. But you have to get to a place where people want to be in that position. And that means taking people with you. But I think that there is a conflict sometimes about, you know, care and, you know, pure versions of liberalism sometimes, or freedom. Curtailing my freedom, though very often, is for a greater freedom. And you argue that... So I think stopping me belching out fumes from my house because I'm not properly insulated, for instance, is not about curtailing my liberty, it's about protecting my children's my neighbours. And that's a key understanding of proper liberalism. It's why, you know, what people will often call libertarianism isn't liberalism at all. Libertarianism is your right to trample over everybody else's freedoms, in which case you're not a liberal. So it is about that balance. But again, we need not to look at... So you talk quite rightly about... We need to build affordable homes, because that's, you know, an important freedom, important access to society. Not the most important access to society is decent, affordable housing, secure housing. And yet if you build it somewhere which is in someone's view, or taking someone's green space, or potentially in the floodplain, you know, you've got to then balance that. And And there's not a 100% right decision.
Yeah.
I think it's important to remember that.
Yeah.
The more I go through my life in politics, the more I realise that those people who are absolute purists are almost always totally wrong.
Yeah.
And those who get the angriest are the ones who achieve the least. And I feel a sense of a loss of reason in our national and international debate. You need to look at any set of Facebook or Twitter discussions
to
think, you know, do these people talk to their children the same way to talk to each other? I really hope they don't. And it's a little sign of the fact that what we need is, whatever the politics you come into a debate with, just treat people like human beings. And understand there's a reasonable chance that the other side debate is being taken for, you know, honourable reasons.
Sure, yeah. I came across some interesting research recently, Tim, you know, quite well thought through, and it was saying that intelligence and education are actually no safeguard against blinkered thinking, because often you have the tools to articulate your way out of dissonance when something, you know,
that's right, yeah.
And what seems key is an openness to being wrong. So this idea again that, you know, we're fallible, and curiosity, and it's often dispositional, but these things are things that you can cultivate.
I came across a really interesting fact. So our new deputy leader, Jo Swinson, made a great speech at the party conference the other week. And in it, she reflected that the question that most precisely defined, the answer to which most precisely defines whether in the UK you voted Leave or Remain, or in the US you voted for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, was not what your social class was, it was not where you live, it wasn't your age, it wasn't your education, amazingly. It was your answer to this question: do you think children should be well-behaved or considerate? And you can probably guess what tells you what.
Yeah.
And now, Jo did at least poke fun at this, saying that as a mother of a three-year-old, she'd settle for either. and I think, and that's the right answer,
by the way.
Because she then said to the audience, who I think had got what answer they should give, or I think it should be, and everyone put their hand up and said considerate.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that does not prove the moral rectitude of Clinton or Remain voters at all. What it proves is that we're just as big a insular tribe as the others are. And if we ever want to solve this new divide in Western politics, then you need to understand the other side and accept them as equals, and understand that you are just as much trapped in your own worldview as they are in theirs.
Yeah, no, I agree. We did a retreat recently, and the title of the retreat was Working with Prejudice.
Mm.
So it's the acknowledgement that we're all subject to prejudice, to blinkered thinking.
Doesn't mean I don't think the other side's wrong.
Yeah,
I don't.
Of course,
But I think we also need to remember that we're the architects of our own failure.
Exactly, yeah. Anyway, you've touched a couple of times now on reason and how much that is related to the idea of liberalism. Now, neuroscience and psychology is now arguing that reason and emotion, contrary to earlier thinking, are inextricably linked in any decision we make. Is that the cat?
It's all right, it's fine. I don't.
Do you mind if I let it?
Yeah, let the cat, absolutely. We used to have two ginger toms called Eric and Ernie.
Come on, you.
Hello. They're a bit of a peculiar interloper.
Come on, I'll leave the door open. Okay, so anyway, right. To what extent would you say modern liberals have taken this on board when engaging with the public in their policies?
In terms of the fact that we're not necessarily rational people,
it's not that we're not, but we're as much emotional beings as we are rational ones.
Of course we are. And I think that so people will say, you know, Brexit was won on emotion, Trump won on emotion, and the opposition to Trump is all about emotion and so on. You've got to remember that there are a few campaigns more emotional than Blair's 97 things can only get better, Britain, you know, Cool Britannia, all the rest of it, and indeed Trudeau's win the other year in Canada. So the thought that only right-wing successes can be based upon emotion, you know, rather centrist ones can be too. And what's Corbynism about other than appeal to emotion? And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And you can find yourself in a situation where if you have lost the hearts of the country, doesn't matter what message you have for their minds. And I've seen it happen where, you know, a person, the messenger is so tarnished that it doesn't matter how good and wise their words, they're lost.
Yeah. I suppose I'm thinking about 3 years ago, there was a debate between Nick Clegg and Nigel Farage. Mm. And I remember watching it and thinking, obviously my bias was kicking in, but I thought Nick Clegg had all the arguments. I thought he's going to win comfortably here. And then the next day I saw the polls.
And that's right.
And I had to acknowledge that Nigel Farage is a canny operator.
That's right.
And
he plays to people's fears and prejudices. What was interesting is that, so I remember those debates very well. I hasten to say I did not do an impression of Nigel Farage. However, I stood in for him when we practiced for those debates with Nick. So I was Nigel. And so you had to come up with the kind of, not just the words that he would use, but the thought processes. And they're so simple and effective. And like all lies, they're based on a grain of truth. Because that gives something to people to hang on to. And we just see the AFD's, you know, advance, modest, and I hope limited advance in Germany. But a lot of that is based upon a grain of truth. And that's all you need in order to turn it into a big, big lie.
Yeah, okay. Next question. The Liberal Democrats are very much seen as a progressive party. How integral is the notion of progress to liberalism?
Well, again, I mean, so to this Liberal, to me, I think, you know, we talk in terms of progressive and reactionary conservative forces, as if that's all there is. When we talk about progressives, it's generally speaking, you know, lazy shorthand or safe shorthand for the centre-left. So Greens, Labour, Liberal Democrats, we balk at including the Nationalists, but we kind of probably do a bit. Scottish and Welsh Nationalists as well. But it's that it's such a broad church.
Yeah.
You know, you've got, you know, people who are nationalists. I always think nationalism is the opposite of liberalism in so many ways. You know, liberalism is by its nature internationalist. And I certainly don't think Marxism it counts as, you know, as a progressive philosophy, at least not in what we would consider normally that word to mean. But in any event, progress. If you just hanker after progress for its sake, then you are slipping into the realms of unreason, aren't you?
Mm.
Because some things work, in which case, let's keep them. And I think, since, you know, so it's good to conserve things. That does not mean you are a conservative.
No.
But there were certainly views in the 60s and 70s that to be progressive meant building horrible tower blocks, some futuristic vision. There's even a minute in Kendal Town Council's meetings from the early 70s where there was a serious consideration of knocking down Kendal Castle. Seriously.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, because it's an eyesore, isn't it? I mean, come off it. So we should be wary of progress for its own sake.
Sure.
Because progress for its own sake ends up in, Orwellian futures or just bad decisions. And so let's not get too hung up. Progressive doesn't necessarily mean progress. It's just become a word which lumps in people who are centre-left but not Marxists.
Okay. In relation to this, prior to the Enlightenment, prosperity was arguably more synonymous with the idea of human flourishing. And it's only perhaps in the last couple of hundred years has it become more associated with material wealth. What are your thoughts on this with regard to liberalism and the social logic tied up with consumerism and the whole notion that growth is essential for prosperity?
Yeah, I mean, growth is a sign of success. It's not necessarily essential for it.
Mm.
I think that the economic success, I should say. I think, materialism is dangerous. I mean, poverty is also dangerous, but it's hard to measure the happiness of any society. And the worry is that what you have is a Western world now ill at ease with itself, with record levels of, you know, mental health problems. I don't want to make some kind of glib analysis here, which is not based on any kind of decent research, but it strongly suggests to me that the quest for prosperity for prosperity's sake, materialism, and then, you know, self-fulfillment and all the rest of it, it actually left us miserable. And so, you know, liberalism should not be about us worshipping ourselves, either with, you know, material gifts or with this notion that we somehow need to be utterly self-fulfilled in order for it to mean anything. Andy Warhol's throwaway will be famous 15 minutes has been totally proven correct. And it's not done us any good. This is not me whining about the internet and wishing it hadn't been invented or anything like that. It's just a reminder that all science, all technology, all progress is neutral. It's what human beings do with it that actually, you know, splitting the atom is not necessarily a bad idea, you know, and all of those things as well. So, I mean, in short, I think that we would want the well-being of every individual. We want people to not have their potential hampered by, you know, a lack of material capabilities. And so the absence of fetters to freedom is something you would want, which is why poverty is a threat to liberty as well as just being a threat to our sense of decency and what's right. But our ability to, you know, have every material thing under the sun is something that, you know, I'm not sure is something I'm going to die in a ditch to defend.
Okay. They were talking about the youth quake on the radio yesterday in British politics, the fact that 70% of voters under, I think, 25 or so, voted Labour, but then around 70% of voters over 65 voted Conservative, and the age of 47 being where both voters are even balanced between Labour and Conservative.
I am 47,
there you go. The values that those Labour voters perhaps are aspiring to are arguably predominantly care and fairness, but Conservative voters also hold those values to a certain degree. However, the values that seem to be strongest in that group of people are usually loyalty, authority and purity. Now, these are values that we all share to a certain degree. It's back to this thing, you know, not sort of demonising, you know, just finding common ground. But, for example, my purity value kicks in when I'm thinking about pollution or helping the disadvantaged. For me, might be seen as an expression of loyalty to the British people as a whole. So I'm wondering to what extent the relationship has been between liberalism and these values. Has there been a certain rejection of them at times? And is there an interest in reframing liberal themes in relation to these values?
I mean, I'll tell you, the one I tried to reclaim and still seek to reclaim as when I was party leader is actually patriotism. And what is patriotism? It is there's nothing wrong with loving your country. It might be irrational, but my support for Blackburn Rovers is totally irrational. But, you know, there were some good times, but it's in the dim and distant past now. But I love my country. I do, and so I want the best for my country. And I think to lead your country onto the rocks for the sake of a bizarre nationalist ideology is anti-patriotic. So I think, you know, liberals should reclaim that sort of language. And yes, liberals and, you know, the liberal left, which is a kind of a more specific thing or maybe a wider thing, has been sniffy about those sorts of things you talk about. There's nothing wrong with starting off with respect for some form of authority. That's right. And basic politeness and treating people kindly, respecting people as a default, whatever happened, and all those sorts of things. And loyalty is I guess that you could argue that loyalty from the far left has generally been something that's done at the end of a barrel of a gun. But loyalty to your community, to your family, to your friends, they're good things. There comes a point where, you know, your loyalty to what is right might have to come before the loyalty to someone you love if they're doing something which is not right. But again, these are balanced judgments. We are flawed beings, and we're making judgments in that flawed environment. And the danger is when we are overly dogmatic in a political sense.
Okay, well, that brings me to this question. What's your understanding of the middle way, Tim, in relation to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not what we're not, it's what we are. And to be, if the middle way is something that is about a non-exploitative, non-dogmatic, reason-based, compassion-based, liberty-based approach to running an economy and a society, then that's something that ought to draw more and more people into it. And my observation is that the majority of people in Britain would want that. Mm. And the majority of people in Britain don't vote for that. And the problem is maybe our electoral system, or maybe it's our culture. We think we have a free press. We don't really. It's owned by three or four people with a really specific agenda. And we can say we're, you know, right-minded, free-thinking individuals. We all have our views formed and affected by the, you know, the media and by those who mediate what we get through it. So for me, liberalism and the middle way, if that is what we're talking about here, is about a way of running a country which is based upon reason, on logic, on compassion, on respecting and nodding towards ideological positions, but not being an absolute foolish stick in the mud and thinking that's the only way you can run things. I mean, on autopilot is fine until autopilot guides you towards a mountainside, in which case, take over the controls and sod the manual, keep yourself in the air. And you know, the manual might tell you that you should, you know, increase public spending or decrease public spending. What you should do is look out the window and see what you should do. So I think the key thing I want us to do in these coming years, yes, to reclaim the notion of patriotism for liberals, also reclaim the notion of common sense, which is not the preserve of the pub bore. It's the preserve of people who respect those of ideological certainty, but believe actually the public interest is the most important thing.
Great. Okay. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for giving up your time today.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Great. Great to see you. Thanks very much. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.